Welcome to Take Note on WPESU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today's guest is Jeffrey Wirt, a historian and author who specializes in the American Civil War. In all, he's written 9 books about the Civil War. His book, Gettysburg Day 3, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award. Wirt also taught at Penns Valley Area High School for more than 3 decades. WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner talked with him about his career as an author and teacher.
Jeffrey Wirt, thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
So you've written 9 books about the Civil War. What brought about your interest in Civil War history?
Well, actually, it goes back to when I was 10 years old, and I lived all my life in Centre County, Pennsylvania. I grew up in the little town of Reversburg at the eastern end, and we have a monument there. It's maybe unique in the state because it marked a spot where roughly 85 men stood in the street of Reversburg in August of 1862 and were sworn into the Union Army. My 5th and 6th grade teacher, his name was Harry Ziegler, and this is in the 1950s. He actually knew some of the Civil War veterans, and he told us some of the stories. And I always liked history up until that time. I had a grandmother who told me stories, and I was intrigued by that. But that's where my interest in the Civil War began. In a sense, too, where the elementary school was in Reversburg, you could walk across the street to the town cemetery, and many of the veterans were buried there. And I used to walk to look to where they were buried in that. So it's been a long time since I've been interested in the Civil War. Over half a century, if I hate to say that, but that's the truth.
So you're a prolific author, but you worked for 33 years, I believe, as a history teacher at a Penns Valley Area High School. You chose to teach as your career instead of just writing full time.
Oh, yes. Well, you have to. Ironically, Penns Valley Area High School is where I graduated as a student. And they offered me a job back in 1969 when I desperately needed a job. And I never thought I would be there, but I stayed for 33 years. I enjoyed teaching. I enjoyed the students. Penns Valley Area High School is a school district is a very fine one. It's the smallest one in Centre County, but we had excellent support from parents. And, no, I never saw my – well – I shouldn't say that. I'd hoped to become a college professor, but it didn't work out. But I ended up with a master's here from Penn State, but I never went on for my PhD.
How did teaching inform how you wrote, or vice versa?
Well, if you ask some of my old students, they will tell you that I was full of stories. I don't know how necessarily to take that, but my research and writing provided me with these stories. And to me, history is utterly fascinating. I tried to convince them of that. But it is. And that's what have always intrigued me. And though I've written primarily in the Civil War, I've written magazine articles from sports to other subjects that just fascinated me. And in turn, towards my latter years of teaching, I taught the advanced placement course in American history in an honors seminar. And in both those courses, students had to write for me. So when I told them that what they wrote wasn't very good, at least I think I had some credibility that they knew that I was writing myself, so I could probably judge what was good and bad. But the other thing, too, any good teacher, whether I was or not, will tell you that you have to be organized. And if you're going to be an historian or a writer, you have to be organized. And so in that sense, I learned things that, from both careers that helped me do what I was doing outside of the classroom.
I've noticed that many reviewers of your books point out how readable your style is, how accessible. I imagine trying to connect with high school students was good practice in keeping things interesting.
I think you're right. I think you have to be clear. And people have been very kind saying that, well, your books are readable. And I tell them, I jokingly, but I mean it, I can't write deep, so I write simple. But I try to tell students, you don't necessarily have to link three or four adverbs together. I remember, just for example, one historian, I was reading his book, and he said that this man came under fire. And while he was under fire, he was, I forget, he used an adverb, but it made no sense. I'm thinking, you know, if you're ever under fire, I don't think that adverb would necessarily work. So it would have been better not to say that and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I do write that. I think clarity is the thing you need. I will tell you that in all my books, the hardest part always has been to start a new chapter and not necessarily what I was going to put in it, but I always wanted to, when I went from one chapter to the next, I wanted to start the next chapter in such a manner that it drew the reader back in. And I, whether I'd done it well or not, you know, but I always tried to do that. But yeah, I tend to write simple.
Though your books have in common the being about the Civil War, you've written about a variety of subjects and a variety of people from both sides. You have Confederate generals, and also you've written about Lincoln and Custer. How do you choose your topics?
Well, that varies. The first book I wrote was on a what we call in the business a campaign study, and that was on my own, and I was fortunate a small press chose to take it. And then I decided, why not try a trade publisher if you're going to make a New York or that? And to do that, I got an agent who we've been together now for more than 25 years. The Custer book, for example, my agent said to me, why don't you write a book on George Custer? And I said, I'll get back to you. George Custer, he's the second most written about American. And after, you know, through 3 days of thinking about it, I said, okay. I ended up, to be honest about it, he's arguably the most fascinating individual I probably have studied. My Jeb Stuart book, who's an equally fascinating, he's a Confederate cavalryman. I was talking to my editor one day, and I just made a mention that some of my cavalry historian friends, somebody needs to write a new biography of Stuart. And my editor says to me, Jeff, we'd be interested in that. So it's that kind of a thing. The majority of books, though, have been my idea, you know. The one thing about it, when you do it with a trade publisher, you have to realize that it's all business. And so you have to come up with a subject that they feel will be saleable. And I like that. They accept or reject your manuscript on the quality of it. And that's one thing I liked about, not to say I have not been disappointed in some of the things I've tried to write for some magazines or something, or had some, I thought, well, this is a brilliant book idea, and nobody shared that with me, and they didn't think it was a very brilliant one. And it's, so, yes, that's how it comes about. But to me, in each case, the story had to appeal to me. Like I did a book on the Confederate Stonewall Brigade and the Union Aaron Brigade, and I took them to the war together. And that book really appealed to me because it was the common soldiers, and it was different than anything I'd done. But the story was so fascinating because they meet three times in battle. And so I could always bring the narrative at points back to them. But it's the story that matters to me. Otherwise, if you're not interested in the story, I don't think you're going to necessarily do a good job.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is Civil War historian and author Jeffrey Wirt. He's talking with WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner about how he chooses what to write about and why Civil War books about the Confederacy are more popular than books about the North.
Again, I've noticed you're kind of equal opportunity. You've covered the Confederate side and the Union side. Your last book was about General Robert E. Lee, and you essentially answered the question of why, despite the string of successes and achievements of his army, they were defeated in Gettysburg. Was it kind of inevitable that you'd write about Robert E. Lee after writing about other men who had worked with him?
I think in part it was, and I wanted to – I thought about that, and – when you measure armies, And that 13-month span that Lee took command of the Army of Northern Virginia is probably the greatest record in American military annals, given the odds against him and what they achieved. And the culmination of it was Gettysburg. And had he won there, well, we don't know. And he didn't. But, yes, that was – and it also was different from my other books in the sense it was a little bit more of analysis and synthesis. Like if you take a Battle of Antietam, it's one chapter. You know, and I didn't go into all the, well, this unit moved here and this unit moved there. And, you know, even I get a little bit bored. The other thing is I will tell you, in the Civil War book business, and that's not the basis from which I'll write this book because I think it'll sell more. But in the Civil War book business, Confederate subjects sell better than Union subjects.
Really?
Oh,
is
yes.
Just the sense of inevitable tragedy or
defeat? Well, and also there's a circuit in the country called Civil War Roundtables. I think there may be 150 or something like that. And I've spoken to numbers of them. And I will tell you that if you go speak to a roundtable in, say, Virginia, or you speak to the Atlanta, Georgia Civil War Roundtable or that, there tends to be more of a passion for it, the war, because it was more, you know, they grew up, many of them, learning what happened to their family and the tragedy. I mean, you know, most economists in that believe that it took the South a century to recover from this war. And, of course, part of that problem inevitably was the fact of the segregation, the social situation down there and things like that. Northerners, I am one, when we talk Civil War, it's a sense of, well, look, we won, so let's get over it.
I mean, right.
Well, down there it's that. And also I will admit to you, this idea of the underdog, and they were much more colorful people. There's this like this northern machine of individuals. Well, and the Southerners, they're much more colorful and that. And it's a generality, but it's true. But as far as books, Civil War art, Civil War artists will do more Confederate subjects to put on a wall than they will do Northern subjects, yeah.
You've done biographies. You did one whole book about the third day of the Battle of Gettysburg. How do you do your research?
I forget what some editor told me when I forget the word, but basically you're like a dinosaur in how you do it. I actually write with – I do my research on note cards yet. I learned it as an undergraduate. I've kept it. I'm comfortable. I write all my books with cheap Papermate pens and legal pads.
Longhand.
The other reason I do that is my wife and I have been married now. This will be our 46th year. And she was a secretary. And she puts everything into the computer for me. And she's also my first editor. And she tells me, sometimes I kid her. I said, you don't have to smile when you tell me it sounds stupid. But we work well. I couldn't do what I do. In fact, in some ways I've said that she should be in the book with title page. But getting back to it, libraries, one of the best things about where I live here in Center County is Carlisle, it's called the Army Heritage Education Center. They have the greatest collection of Civil War diaries and letters and photographs in the country. But then you also go to certain sites, National Archives, Library of Congress. But if you're going to do like Lee's book, or I did my biography of Jeb Stuart, there's a wealth of material, Virginia Historical Society, Museum of the Confederacy. But I've gotten them from all over the country, libraries. Penn State has some Civil War stuff that I've used that's been very helpful. And it's just the standard, you know, you go to these places, historical societies or the university libraries or state archives or that, yes.
I saw you joined Facebook with the help of your daughter. And you've talked about, you refer to yourself or your editor referred to you as the dinosaur.
I'm on Facebook because my publisher told me I should be in Facebook. I don't post. My daughter helped me set it up, and rarely with close personal friends, if something happens or their birthday or something, I will say something. I find it very difficult to promote myself. It's just a personal, It's not a good thing, but I work in the theory, if you have to brag about something, it's probably not worth bragging about. So I tend not to – I know publishers – my publisher not necessarily would think that's a good idea, but I am. I will say the one thing I have done, and that's part of the world we live in, I gathered a lot of material from the internet. Now, please, I don't go to Wikipedia. I mean, there's this wonderful collection of materials at a small Navarro College in Texas, and they'll either send you copies or you can pull things down actually from what they have posted on there. And it's a matter of time and money. I mean, instead of going to Texas, that. But, yes, I am on Facebook, but people don't find me commenting too much on Facebook. If I write another book, I'm hoping to write another book. When it comes out, I will let people know on Facebook, but generally that's me.
So you're in the process of another book right now.
I'm doing some research. My agent and I are talking about possible proposals. Even though we're in the sesquicentennial, right now the hottest field in American military history is actually the Second World War. But I know little about where to go there, so I won't. But I plan to. I'm looking at some ideas. I haven't necessarily settled on anything. But the book business, I hate to say this, like the economy, has not been particularly good over the last 4 or 5 years. And that's understandable. People are having difficulties. But, yeah, I hope to do another book, yes.
And you mentioned the Second World War. Are you open to branching out of the Civil War?
Oh, yes. I'm more interested in earlier American history compared to Second World War or that. And I'm even interested – I mean, I could do non-military. As I said, if I find a subject that really intrigues me and somebody, a publisher, says, yeah, that's a good idea, I could do that. My Custer book, for example – the most fascinating part of that book to me was actually his relationship with his wife, Libby. It wasn't the military part. I mean, I've done military. As I said, you know, you get tired of having people die and people being wounded and writing about that and constantly. And there was a very passionate relationship and the letters between them and all that. And I found a little bit, too, with Jeb Stuart. He was devoted to his wife, Flora, and his letters to her are intriguing. It's all that. It's just about – I can write – as long as it's a human condition and a good story, I'm happy with it, yes.
Have you considered writing fiction?
No, I'm not good enough to write fiction. I'm simply not. You have to be a plot and it has to be characterization. No, I'm an historian who steals from other people, I guess, is the way – no, I haven't. I did one article once, which is a counterfactual article. It was, what if Lee won at Gettysburg? And it was in the immediate aftermath of that. And when the editor of the magazine asked me to do it, I said, I don't know if I want to do that. I didn't think I'd like it, and yet I found it to be very – it was a lot of fun. But to do a fictional book, no, I don't think I could write a novel. I'm not good enough.
You know, there's a lot of interest for people to research their genealogy. Have you had families contact you about people you've mentioned in your books or, I guess, more personal requests to get in touch with their history?
Yes, I have. But give you an example. My second book was in Mosby's Ranger, John Mosby. His best friend was Fount Beattie. My book came out. Unfortunately, it happens, and other authors say that. It's when your book comes out, people who are family or something will contact you. And here his granddaughter contacted me. I think she was in her mid-80s. She remembered sitting at Sunday dinner tables with John Mosby with her grandfather. You know, and she was like 4 or 5 years old, and she told me some wonderful stories that she remembered. For example, Mosby, I always thought he was probably agnostic, and his wife was Catholic, and his wife sent him a Catholic Bible, and he gave it to Fount Beattie. Fount Beattie started reading it, and the Beattie family converted to Catholicism, and they were Catholic. And little things you'd like to just put in there. Another thing I like, too, in that, and I've had local people particularly say, you know, I had a good friend who told me, he said, well, my great-grandfather fought at Gettysburg. I said, oh, okay. He said, did you check it out? Sure. Well, I had to go back and tell him, I said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your great-grandfather enlisted 1 year after Gettysburg. So, and I do. I had a great-grandfather who fought in the war. My wife had a great-great-uncle who actually died at Andersonville prison camp. You know, so there's that. And but local things, too. Well, I'm a homegrown boy in that sense, so I've never left there. And my wife's from, family's from Pennsylvania Valley, too. So there are people who we grew up together, families who will ask me stuff that, can you check this out? And I'm always happy to do it.
Who's the most fascinating person in American history that you may or may not have written a book about?
Well, as an historian, you know, you're not supposed to have heroes in the sense of that. But there's no question to me that it's Abraham Lincoln. He's, to me, the most fascinating American I've studied. His humility, his kindness, his compassion, and besides the fact of how he could write, but everything about Lincoln, I mean, you know, he was, today he'd be probably diagnosed as depressed, you know, clinically depressed. He called, of course, melancholia and all that. No man has honestly intrigued me more than Abraham Lincoln.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is Civil War historian and author Jeffrey Word. He spoke with WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner last month about Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address.
It's been 149 years since Lincoln's second inaugural address. Most of our listeners are familiar with the Gettysburg Address and why that's important. What's the significance of this less talked about speech, which some, including Lincoln, actually considered his greatest speech?
The language is very moving, a lot of religious undertones to the message, and it's almost a speech in which Lincoln's removed from it. Only in the first paragraph is there the I, but after that it's very impersonal. He talks about the coming of the war and who's to blame for it, and he attributes it correctly to slavery, and then he basically calls it a national sin. And then what he does is he says that this nation has paid for that sin, and they're paying for that sin with this terrible civil war. And both the North and the South has to pay for the sin of, the, as he called it, the unrequited labor for 250 years of slaves. And if it was drawn with the lash, it is now being drawn with the sword. But the language is just ringing. It's unlike any other inaugural address in our history. It's clear. Well, of course, Lincoln arguably is unlike any other president in our history with his command of language.
Well, let's back up a little bit. What's the context of the speech?
Well, the context was the war would be over in 5 weeks. And he notes that in the speech, only that he doesn't know the end. But most of the thousands of people in the audience pretty well knew that the end was at hand. And so therefore, he said it was not necessary to go over the progress of the war. It is progressing to where it wants to be. And so then he finally reminds the audience that once this war ends, there's this great task remaining before us. And he also, though, spoke to the fact that what happens after the war, and that we know is Reconstruction. He alluded to the fact that there's no certain answers to this. And Lincoln is very pragmatic, and he's always been. He reminded his audience in this that, as he would say earlier, that he never controlled events. Events that controlled him. And once more, events will control the country as they try to heal the wounds. So as the war's ending is approaching, it's a look in a sense forward besides a look in the past.
It's worth noting that the speech was quite short. It was around 700 words. It's an inaugural address, and Lincoln is speaking, you know, towards the end of the war. There's a lot he could talk about, but he chooses to be brief.
He not only chooses to be brief, but if you think about it, it's a rather harsh speech to the American people in the fact that, you know, we have as a nation, as I said before, sinned. And this is what we are paying for that sin, and it's God's will. And that's the other thing about the speech, where Lincoln has evolved so much in his religious beliefs from when he was a young man to where he is. He always was fatalistic. His parents were Baptist. In a sense, he saw predestination, but it wasn't necessarily that he believed it was guided by a God, the Lord. Maybe it was more the laws of nature. But this inaugural address is very profound in its religious undertones, if you will. In fact, you could argue that it's even more than an undertone. He quotes Matthew in the speech. So most inaugural addresses, as we know in modern times, it's almost saying, well, either if it's the first term, it's what we're going to achieve. If it's the second term, it's what we have achieved and then looking forward. This was none of that applied here necessarily. As I said, it's a very impersonal address.
And why do you think he chose that tactic?
I believe he chose that because he felt that it had to be said, and American people had to understand. And as I said earlier, it's preparing them for a clearly uncertain future about how do we heal this? And today we believe that perhaps not 620,000 men fell from disease or battle wounds, but perhaps maybe 750,000. So we're talking 750,000 men, and we have obligations to that. And it is a very difficult mission. Of course, sadly and tragically, we know that he didn't live to do that.
What's the lasting significance of this speech?
It's just the poetry of it all. It has never been matched. We think of Kennedy's moment, but Kennedy had a phrase that just rang. But Lincoln's entire speech just rings.
Would you mind reading the last paragraph?
Oh, no, certainly. With mouths toward none, with charity for all, with the firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who has borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which we may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
That was WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner talking with Jeffrey Wirt. Wirt has published 9 books about the American Civil War. One of his books about the Battle of Gettysburg was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Wirt is a lifelong resident of Penns Valley, where he taught high school for 33 years. To learn more, visit our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.